Disc 3.
Superintendent Harper's manner was slow and pleasant and absolutely non-committal. These cases where the police of two counties had to collaborate were always difficult. He liked Colonel Melchett and considered him an able chief constable, but he was nevertheless glad to be tackling the present interview by himself. Never do too much at once, was Superintendent Harper's rule. Bare routine inquiry for the first time. That left the persons you were interviewing relieved and predisposed them to be more unguarded in the next interview you had with them. Harper already knew Raymond Starr by sight. A fine-looking specimen, tall, lithe and good-looking, with very white teeth and a deeply bronzed face. He was dark and graceful. He had a pleasant, friendly manner and was very popular in the hotel. "I'm afraid I can't help you much, Superintendent. I knew Ruby quite well, of course. She'd been here over a month, and we'd practiced our dances together and all that. But there's really very little to say. She was quite a pleasant and rather stupid girl." "It's her friendships we're particularly anxious to know about. Her friendships with men." "Oh, so I suppose. Well, I don't know anything. She'd got a few young men in tow in the hotel, but nothing special. You see, she was nearly always monopolized by the Jefferson family." "Ah, yes, the Jefferson family." Harper paused meditatively. He shot a shrewd glance at the young man. "What do you think of that business, Mr. Starr?" Raymond Starr said coolly, "What business?" Harper said, "Did you know that Mr. Jefferson was proposing to adopt Ruby Keene legally?" This appeared to be news to Starr. He pursed up his lips and whistled. He said, "The clever little devil. Oh, well, there's no fool like an old fool." "That how it strikes you, is it? Well, what else can one say? If the old boy wanted to adopt someone, why didn't he pick upon a girl of his own class?" "Ruby Keene never mentioned the matter to you?" "No, she didn't. I knew she was elated about something, but I didn't know what it was." "And Josie?" "Oh, I think Josie must have known what was in the wind. Probably she was the one who planned the whole thing. Josie's no fool. She's got a head on her, that girl." Harper nodded. It was Josie who had sent for Ruby Keene. Josie, no doubt, who had encouraged the intimacy. No wonder she'd been upset when Ruby had failed to show up for her dance that night and Conway Jefferson had begun to panic. She was envisaging her plans going awry. He asked, "Could Ruby keep a secret, do you think?" "As well as most. She didn't talk about her own affairs much." "Did she ever say anything at all, about some friend of hers? Someone from her former life who was coming to see her here, or whom she had had difficulty with? You know the sort of thing I mean, no doubt." "I know perfectly. Well, as far as I'm aware, there was no one of the kind, not by anything she ever said." "Thank you, Mr. Starr. Now, will you just tell me in your own words exactly what happened last night?" "Certainly. Ruby and I did our 10:30 dance together. No signs of anything unusual about her then?" Raymond considered. "I don't think so. I didn't notice what happened afterwards. I had my own partners to look after. I do remember noticing she wasn't in the ballroom. At midnight, she hadn't turned up. I was very annoyed and went to Josie about it. Josie was playing bridge with the Jeffersons. She hadn't any idea where Ruby was, and I think she got a bit of a jolt. I noticed her shoot a quick, anxious glance at Mr. Jefferson. I persuaded the band to play another dance, and I went to the office and got them to ring up to Ruby's room. There wasn't any answer. I went back to Josie. She suggested that Ruby was perhaps asleep in her room. Idiotic suggestion, really, but it was meant for the Jeffersons, of course. She came away with me and said we'd go up together." "Yes, Mr. Starr, and what did she say when she was alone with you?" "As far as I can remember, she looked very angry and said, 'Damned little fool, she can't do this sort of thing, it'll ruin all her chances. Who's she with, do you know?' I said I hadn't the least idea. The last I'd seen of her was dancing with young Bartlett. Josie said, 'Oh, she wouldn't be with him. What can she be up to? She isn't with that film man, is she?' Harper said sharply, "Film man? Who was he?" Raymond said, "I don't know his name. He's never stayed here. Rather an unusual-looking chap. Black hair and theatrical-looking. He has something to do with the film industry, I believe, or so he told Ruby. He came over to dine here once or twice and danced with Ruby afterwards, but I don't think she knew him at all well. That's why I was surprised when Josie mentioned him. I said I didn't think he'd been here tonight. Josie said, 'Well, she must be out with someone. What on earth am I going to say to the Jeffersons?' I said, 'What did it matter to the Jeffersons?' And Josie said that it did matter. And she said, too, that she'd never forgive Ruby if she went and messed things up. Well, we'd got to Ruby's room by then. She wasn't there, of course, but she'd been there because the dress she'd been wearing was lying across a chair. Josie looked in the wardrobe and said she thought she'd put on her old white dress. Normally she'd have changed into a black velvet dress for our Spanish dance. I was pretty angry by this time at the way Ruby had let me down. Josie did her best to soothe me and said she'd dance herself, so that old Prescott shouldn't get after us all. She went away and changed her dress, and we went down and did a tango. Exaggerated style and quite showy, but not really too exhausting upon the ankles. Josie was very plucky about it, for it hurt her, I could see. After that, she asked me to help her soothe the Jeffersons down. She said it was important. So, of course, I did what I could." Superintendent Harper nodded. He said, "Thank you, Mr. Starr." To himself, he thought, it was important, all right. £50,000. He watched Raymond Starr as the latter moved gracefully away. He went down the steps of the terrace, picking up a bag of tennis balls and a racket on the way. Mrs. Jefferson, also carrying a racket, joined him, and they went towards the tennis courts. "Ah, excuse me, sir." Sergeant Higgins, rather breathless, stood at Harper's side. The superintendent, jerked from the train of thought he was following, looked startled.
"Message just come through for you from headquarters, sir. Labourer reported this morning saw glare as of fire. Half an hour ago they found a burnt-out car in a quarry, Van's quarry, about 2 miles from here. Traces of a charred body inside."
A flush came over Harper's heavy features. He said, "What's come to Glenshire? An epidemic of violence? Don't tell me we're going to have a Rouse case now." He asked, "Could they get the number of the car?"
No, sir, but we'll be able to identify it, of course, by the engine number. A Minoan 14, they think it is."
Sir Henry Clithering, as he passed through the lounge of the Majestic, hardly glanced at its occupants. His mind was preoccupied. Nevertheless, as is the way of life, something registered in his subconscious. It waited its time patiently. Sir Henry was wondering, as he went upstairs, just what had induced the sudden urgency of his friend's message. Conway Jefferson was not the type of man who sent urgent summonses to anyone. Something quite out of the usual must have occurred, decided Sir Henry. Jefferson wasted no time in beating about the bush. He said,
"Glad you've come. Edwards, get Sir Henry a drink. Sit down, man. You've not heard anything, I suppose. Nothing in the papers yet?"
Sir Henry shook his head, his curiosity aroused.
"What's the matter?" "Murder's the matter. I'm concerned in it. And so are your friends, the Bantrys."
"Arthur and Dolly Bantry?"
Clithering sounded incredulous.
"Yes, you see, the body was found in their house."
Clearly and succinctly, Conway Jefferson ran through the facts. Sir Henry listened without interrupting. Both men were accustomed to grasping the gist of a matter. Sir Henry, during his term as Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, had been renowned for his quick grip on essentials.
"It's an extraordinary business," he commented, when the other had finished. "How do the Bantrys come into it, do you think?"
"Well, that's what worries me. You see, Henry, it looks to me as though possibly the fact that I know them might have a bearing on the case. That's the only connection I can find. Neither of them, I gather, ever saw the girl before. Well, that's what they say, and there's no reason to disbelieve them. It's most unlikely they should know her. Then isn't it possible that she was decoyed away and her body deliberately left in the house of friends of mine?
Clithering said, I think that's far-fetched.
It's possible, though, persisted the other.
Yes, but unlikely. What do you want me to do?
Conway Jefferson said bitterly, I'm an invalid. I disguise the fact, refuse to face it. But now it comes home to me. I can't go about as I'd like to. Asking questions, looking into things. I've got to stay here, meekly grateful for such scraps of information as the police are kind enough to dole out to me.
Do you happen to know Melchett, by the way, the chief constable of Radfordshire?
Yes, I've met him. Something stirred into Henry's brain, a face and figure noted unseeingly as he passed through the lounge. A straight-backed old lady whose face was familiar. It linked up with the last time he had seen Melchett. He said,
"Do you mean you want me to be a kind of amateur sleuth? That's not my line."
Jefferson said, "You're not an amateur, that's just it."
"I'm not a professional any more. I'm on the retired list now."
Jefferson said, "That simplifies matters."
"Oh, you mean if I was still at Scotland Yard I couldn't butt in? Well, that's perfectly true."
"As it is," said Jefferson, "your experience qualifies you to take an interest in the case, and any cooperation you offer will be welcomed." Clithering said slowly,
"Etiquette permits, I agree, but what do you really want, Conway? To find out who killed this girl?"
"Just that."
"You've no idea yourself?"
"None whatever."
Sir Henry said slowly, "You probably won't believe me, but you've got an expert at solving mysteries sitting downstairs in the lounge at this very minute. Someone who's better than I am at it, and who in all probability may have some local dope."
"What are you talking about?"
"Downstairs in the lounge, by the third pillar from the left, there sits an old lady, with a sweet, placid, spinsterish face, and a mind that has plumbed the depths of human iniquity and taken it as all in the day's work. Her name's Miss Marple. She comes from the village of St. Mary Mead, which is a mile and a half from Gossington. She's a friend of the Bantries, and where crime is concerned, she's the goods, Conway."
Jefferson stared at him with thick, puckered brows. He said heavily, "You're joking."
"No, I'm not. You spoke of Melchett just now. The last time I saw Melchett, there was a village tragedy. Girl supposed to have drowned herself. Police, quite rightly, suspected that it wasn't suicide but murder. They thought they knew who did it. Along to me comes old Miss Marple, fluttering and dithering. She's afraid, she says, they'll hang the wrong person. She's got no evidence, but she knows who did do it. Hands me a piece of paper with a name written on it. And by God, Jefferson, she was right."
Conway Jefferson's brows came down lower than ever. He grunted disbelievingly.
"Women's intuition, I suppose," he said, skeptically. "No, she doesn't call it that. Specialized knowledge is her claim."
"And what does that mean?"
"Well, you know, Jefferson, we use it in police work. We get a burglary, and we usually know pretty well who did it, of the regular crowd, that is. We know the sort of burglar who acts in a particular sort of way. Miss Marple has an interesting, though occasionally trivial, series of parallels from village life."
Jefferson said skeptically,
"What is she likely to know about a girl who's been brought up in a theatrical milieu and probably never been in a village in her life?"
"I think," said Sir Henry Clithering firmly, "that she might have ideas." Miss Marple flushed with pleasure as Sir Henry bore down upon her.
"Oh, Sir Henry, this is indeed a great piece of luck, meeting you here."
Sir Henry was gallant. He said, "To me it is a great pleasure." Miss Marple murmured, flushing, "So kind of you."
"Are you staying here?"
"Well, as a matter of fact, we are."
"We?"
"Mrs. Bantry's here, too."
She looked at him sharply.
"Have you heard yet?"
"Yes, I can see you have. It is terrible, is it not?" "What's Dolly Bantry doing here? Is her husband here, too?"
"No. Naturally, they both reacted quite differently. Colonel Bantry, poor man, just shuts himself up in his study, or goes down to one of the farms when anything like this happens. Like tortoises, you know, they draw their heads in and hope nobody will notice them. Dolly, of course, is quite different."
"Dolly, in fact," said Sir Henry, who knew his old friend fairly well, "is almost enjoying herself, eh?"
Well, yes, poor dear.
"And she's brought you along to produce the rabbits out of the hat for her."
Miss Marple said composedly, "Dolly thought that a change of scene would be a good thing, and she didn't want to come alone." She met his eye, and her own gently twinkled. "But, of course, your way of describing it is quite true. It's rather embarrassing for me, because, of course, I am no use at all."
"No ideas? No village parallels?"
"I don't know very much about it all yet."
"I can remedy that, I think. I'm going to call you into consultation, Miss Marple."
He gave a brief recital of the course of events. Miss Marple listened with keen interest. "Poor Mr. Jefferson," she said. "What a very sad story. These terrible accidents. To leave him alive, crippled, seems more cruel than if he had been killed too."
"Yes, indeed. That's why all his friends admire him so much, for the resolute way he's gone on, conquering pain and grief and physical disabilities."
"Yes, it is splendid."
"The only thing I can't understand is this sudden outpouring of affection for this girl. She may, of course, have had some remarkable qualities."
"Probably not," said Miss Marple placidly.
"You don't think so?"
"I don't think her qualities entered into it."
Sir Henry said, "He isn't just a nasty old man, you know."
"Oh, no, no." Miss Marple got quite pink. "I wasn't implying that for a minute. What I was trying to say was, very badly, I know, that he was just looking for a nice, bright girl to take his dead daughter's place. And then this girl saw her opportunity and played it for all she was worth. That sounds uncharitable, I know, but I have seen so many cases of the kind. The young maid-servant at Mr. Harbottle's, for instance, a very ordinary girl, but quiet, with nice manners. His sister was called away to nurse a dying relative, and when she got back, she found the girl completely above herself, sitting down in the drawing-room, laughing and talking, and not wearing her cap or apron. Miss Harbottle spoke to her very sharply, and the girl was impertinent. And then old Mr. Harbottle left her quite dumbfounded by saying that he thought she had kept house for him long enough, and that he was making other arrangements. Such a scandal as it created in the village. But poor Miss Harbottle had to go and live most uncomfortably in rooms in Eastbourne. People said things, of course, but I believe there was no familiarity of any kind. It was simply that the old man found it much pleasanter to have a young, cheerful girl telling him how clever and amusing he was than to have his sister continually pointing out his faults to him, even if she was a good economical manager. There was a moment's pause, and then Miss Marple resumed. And there was Mr. Badger, who had the chemist's shop, made a lot of fuss over the young lady who worked in his toilet section, told his wife they must look on her as a daughter and have her to live in the house. Mrs. Badger didn't see it that way at all. Sir Henry said,
"If she'd only been a girl in his own rank of life, a friend's child—"
Miss Marple interrupted him. "Oh, but that wouldn't have been nearly as satisfactory from his point of view. It's like King Cophetua and the beggar maid. If you're really rather a lonely, tired old man, and if, perhaps, your own family have been neglecting you—" She paused for a second. "Well, to befriend someone who will be overwhelmed with your magnificence, to put it rather melodramatically, but I hope you see what I mean, well, that's much more interesting. It makes you feel a much greater person, a beneficent monarch. The recipient is more likely to be dazzled, and that, of course, is a pleasant feeling for you." She paused and said, "Mr. Badger, you know,
bought the girl in his shop some really fantastic presents, a diamond bracelet and a most expensive radio gramophone. Took out a lot of his savings to do so. However, Mrs. Badger, who was a much more astute woman than poor Miss Harbottle, marriage, of course, helps, took the trouble to find out a few things. And when Mr. Badger discovered that the girl was carrying on with a very undesirable young man connected with the racecourses, and had actually pawned the bracelet to give him the money, well, he was completely disgusted, and the affair passed over quite safely, and he gave Mrs. Badger a diamond ring the following Christmas. Her pleasant, shrewd eyes met Sir Henry's. He wondered if what she had been saying was intended as a hint. He said, "Are you suggesting that if there had been a young man in Ruby Keene's life, my friend's attitude towards her might have altered?" "It probably would, you know. I dare say in a year or two he might have liked to arrange for her marriage himself, though more likely he wouldn't. Gentlemen are usually rather selfish. But I certainly think that if Ruby Keene had had a young man, she'd have been careful to keep very quiet about it."
"And the young man might have resented that?"
"I suppose that is the most plausible solution. It struck me, you know, that her cousin, the young woman who was at Gossington this morning, looked definitely angry with the dead girl. What you've told me explains why. No doubt she was looking forward to doing very well out of the business."
"Rather a cold-blooded character, in fact."
"That's too harsh a judgment, perhaps. The poor thing has had to earn her living, and you can't expect her to sentimentalize because a well-to-do man and woman, as you have described Mr. Gaskell and Mrs. Jefferson, are going to be done out of a further large sum of money, to which they have really no particular moral right. I should say Miss Turner was a hard-headed, ambitious young woman, with a good temper and considerable joie de vivre. A little," added Miss Marple, "like Jessie Golden, the baker's daughter."
"What happened to her?" asked Sir Henry.
"She trained as a nursery governess and married the son of the house, who was home on leave from India. Made him a very good wife, I believe."
Sir Henry pulled himself clear of these fascinating side issues. He said, "Is there any reason, do you think, why my friend Conway Jefferson should suddenly have developed this coffetua complex, if you like to call it that?"
"There might have been."
"In what way?"
Miss Marple said, hesitating a little, "I should think, it's only a suggestion, of course, that perhaps his son-in-law and daughter-in-law might have wanted to get married again."
"Well, surely he couldn't have objected to that."
"Oh, no, not objected. But, you see, you must look at it from his point of view. He had a terrible shock and loss. So had they. The three bereaved people live together, and the link between them is the loss they have all sustained. But time, as my dear mother used to say, is a great healer. Mr. Gaskell and Mrs. Jefferson are young. Without knowing it themselves, they may have begun to feel restless, to resent the bonds that tied them to their past sorrow. And so, feeling like that, old Mr. Jefferson would have become conscious of a sudden lack of sympathy without knowing its cause. It's usually that. Gentlemen so easily feel neglected. With Mr. Harbottle, it was Miss Harbottle going away. And with the Badgers, it was Mrs. Badger taking such an interest in spiritualism and always going out to seances."
"I must say," said Sir Henry ruefully, "that I dislike the way you reduce us all to the general common denominator."
Miss Marple shook her head sadly. "Human nature is very much the same anywhere, Sir Henry."
Sir Henry said distastefully, "Mr. Harbottle, Mr. Badger, and poor Conway, I hate to intrude the personal note, but have you any parallel for my humble self in your village?"
"Well, of course, there is Briggs."
"Who's Briggs?"
"He was the head gardener up at Old Hall. Quite the best man they ever had. Knew exactly when the undergardeners were slacking off. Quite uncanny it was. He managed with only three men and a boy, and the place was better kept than it had been with six. and took several firsts with his sweet peas. He's retired now.
Like me, said Sir Henry.
But he still does a little jobbing, if he likes the people.
Ah, said Sir Henry, again like me. That's what I'm doing now, jobbing to help an old friend.
Two old friends.
Two?
Sir Henry looked a little puzzled. Miss Marple said, I suppose you meant Mr. Jefferson, but I wasn't thinking of him. I was thinking of Colonel and Mrs. Bantry.
Yes, yes, I see, he asked sharply. Was that why you alluded to Dolly Bantry as poor dear at the beginning of our conversation?
Yes. She hasn't begun to realize things yet. I know because I've had more experience. You see, Sir Henry, it seems to me that there's a great possibility of this crime being the kind of crime that never does get solved, like the Brighton Trunk murders. But if that happens, it will be absolutely disastrous for the Bantrys. Colonel Bantry, like nearly all retired military men, is really abnormally sensitive. He reacts very quickly to public opinion. He won't notice it for some time, and then it will begin to go home to him. A slight here, and a snub there, and invitations that are refused, and excuses that are made, and then, little by little, it will dawn upon him, and he'll retire into his shell and get terribly morbid and miserable.
Let me be sure I understand you rightly, Miss Marple. You mean that because the body was found in his house, people will think that he had something to do with it?
Of course they will. I've no doubt they're saying so already. They'll say so more and more, and people will cold-shoulder the Bantrys and avoid them. That's why the truth has got to be found out, and why I was willing to come here with Mrs. Bantry. An open accusation is one thing, and quite easy for a soldier to meet. He's indignant, and he has a chance of fighting, but this other whispering business will break him, will break them both. So you see, Sir Henry, we've got to find out the truth.
Sir Henry said, "Any ideas as to why the body should have been found in his house? There must be an explanation of that, some connection."
"Oh, of course.
The girl was last seen here about 11:20. By midnight, according to the medical evidence, she was dead. Gossington's about 18 miles from here. Good road for 16 of those miles, until one turns off the main road. A powerful car could do it in well under half an hour." Practically any car could average 35. But why anyone should either kill her here and take her body out to Gossington, or should take her out to Gossington and strangle her there, I don't know.
Of course you don't, because it didn't happen.
Do you mean that she was strangled by some fellow who took her out in a car, and he then decided to push her into the first likely house in the neighbourhood?
I don't think anything of the kind. I think there was a very careful plan made. What happened was that the plan went wrong.
Sir Henry stared at her. Why did the plan go wrong?
Miss Marple said, rather apologetically, Such curious things happen, don't they? If I were to say that this particular plan went wrong because human beings are so much more vulnerable and sensitive than anyone thinks, it wouldn't sound sensible, would it? But that's what I believe. And, she broke off, here's Mrs. Bantry now.
Mrs. Bantry was with Adelaide Jefferson. The former came up to Sir Henry and exclaimed, You!
I, myself.
He took both her hands and pressed them warmly.
I can't tell you how distressed I am at all this, Mrs. B.
Mrs. Bantry said mechanically, Don't call me Mrs. B, and went on, Arthur isn't here. He's taking it all rather seriously. Miss Marple and I have come here to sleuth. Do you know Mrs. Jefferson?
Yes, of course.
He shook hands. Adelaide Jefferson said, Have you seen my father-in-law?
Yes, I have.
I'm glad. We are anxious about him. It was a terrible shock.
Mrs. Bantry said, Let's come out onto the terrace and have drinks and talk about it all.
The four of them went out and joined Mark Gaskell, who was sitting at the extreme end of the terrace by himself. After a few desultory remarks and the arrival of the drinks, Mrs. Bantry plunged straight into the subject with her usual zest for direct action.
"We can talk about it, can't we?" she said. I mean, we're all old friends, except Miss Marple, and she knows all about crime, and she wants to help.
Mark Gaskell looked at Miss Marple in a somewhat puzzled fashion. He said doubtfully,
"Do you write detective stories?"
The most unlikely people he knew wrote detective stories, and Miss Marple, in her old-fashioned spinster's clothes, looked a singularly unlikely person.
"Oh, no, I'm not clever enough for that."
"She's wonderful," said Mrs. Bantry impatiently. "I can't explain now, but she is. Now, Addie, I want to know all about things. What was she really like, this girl?"
"Well," Adelaide Jefferson paused, glanced across at Mark and half laughed. She said, "You're so direct."
"Did you like her?"
"No, of course I didn't."
"What was she really like?"
Mrs. Bantry shifted her inquiry to Mark Gaskell. Mark said deliberately, "Common or garden gold digger. And she knew her stuff. She'd got her hooks into Jeff all right."
Both of them called their father-in-law Jeff.
Sir Henry thought, looking disapprovingly at Mark, "Indiscreet fellow, shouldn't be so outspoken." He had always disapproved a little of Mark Gaskell. The man had charm, but he was unreliable, talked too much, was occasionally boastful, not quite to be trusted, Sir Henry thought. He had sometimes wondered if Conway Jefferson thought so too.
"But couldn't you do something about it?" demanded Mrs. Bantry.
Mark said dryly, "We might have, if we'd realized it in time."
He shot a glance at Adelaide, and she coloured faintly. There had been reproach in that glance. She said, "Mark thinks I ought to have seen what was coming."
"You left the old boy alone too much, Addie. Tennis lessons and all the rest of it."
"Well, I had to have some exercise," she spoke apologetically. "Anyway, I never dreamed."
"No," said Mark, "neither of us ever dreamed. Jeff has always been such a sensible, level-headed old boy."
Miss Marple made a contribution to the conversation. "Gentlemen," she said, with her old maid's way of referring to the opposite sex, as though it were a species of wild animal, "are frequently not as level-headed as they seem."
"I'll say you're right," said Mark. "Unfortunately, Miss Marple, we didn't realize that. We wondered what the old boy saw in that rather insipid and meretricious little bag of tricks. But we were pleased for him to be kept happy and amused. We thought there was no harm in her."
"No harm in her? I wish I'd wrung her neck."
"Mark," said Addie, "you really must be careful what you say."
He grinned at her engagingly. "I suppose I must. Otherwise people will think I actually did wring her neck. Oh, well, I suppose I'm under suspicion anyway. If anyone had an interest in seeing that girl dead, it was Addie and myself."
"Mark," cried Mrs. Jefferson, half laughing and half angry, "you really mustn't."
"All right, all right," said Mark Gaskell pacifically. "But I do like speaking my mind. £50,000 our esteemed father-in-law was proposing to settle upon that half-baked, nit-witted little slypuss."
"Mark, you mustn't. She's dead."
"Yes, she's dead, poor little devil. And after all, why shouldn't she use the weapons that nature gave her? Who am I to judge? Done plenty of rotten things myself in my life. No, let's say Ruby was entitled to plot and scheme, and we were mugs not to have tumbled to her game sooner."
Sir Henry said,
"What did you say when Conway told you he proposed to adopt the girl?"
Mark thrust out his hands.
What could we say? Addie, always the little lady, retained her self-control admirably, put a brave face upon it. I endeavoured to follow her example.
"I should have made a fuss," said Mrs. Bantry.
"Well, frankly speaking, we weren't entitled to make a fuss. It was Jeff's money. We weren't his flesh and blood. He's always been damn good to us. There was nothing for it but to bite on the bullet."
He added reflectively, "But we didn't love little Ruby."
Adelaide Jefferson said, "If only it had been some other kind of girl. Jeff had two godchildren, you know. If it had been one of them, well, one would have understood it." She added, with a shade of resentment, "And Jeff's always seemed so fond of Peter."
"Of course," said Mrs. Bantry.
I always have known Peter was your first husband's child, but I've quite forgotten it. I've always thought of him as Mr. Jefferson's grandson.
So have I, said Adelaide. Her voice held a note that made Miss Marple turn in her chair and look at her.
It was Josie's fault, said Mark. Josie brought her here.
Adelaide said, Oh, but surely you don't think it was deliberate, do you? Why, you've always liked Josie so much.
Yes, I did like her. I thought she was a good sport.
It was sheer accident, her bringing the girl down.
Josie's got a good head on her shoulders, my girl.
Yes, but she couldn't foresee.
Mark said, No, she couldn't, I admit it. I'm not really accusing her of planning the whole thing, but I've no doubt she saw which way the wind was blowing long before we did, and kept very quiet about it.
Adelaide said with a sigh, I suppose one can't blame her for that.
Mark said, Ho-ho, we can't blame anyone for anything.
Mrs. Bantry asked, Was Ruby Keene very pretty?
Mark stared at her.
I thought you'd seen...
Mrs. Bantry said hastily, Oh, yes, yes, I saw her, her body, but she'd been strangled, you know, and one couldn't tell that...
She shivered.
Mark said thoughtfully, I don't think she was really pretty at all.
She certainly wouldn't have been without any make-up. A thin, ferrety little face. Not much chin, teeth running down her throat, nondescript sort of nose.
Oh, it sounds revolting, said Mrs. Bantry.
Oh, no, she wasn't. As I say, with make-up she managed to give quite an effect of good looks. Don't you think so, Addie?
Yes, rather chocolate box, pink and white business. She had nice blue eyes.
Yes, innocent baby stare. And the heavily blacked lashes brought out the blueness. Her hair was bleached, of course. It's true, when I come to think of it, that in colouring, artificial colouring anyway, she had a kind of spurious resemblance to Rosamond, my wife, you know. I dare say that's what attracted the old man's attention to her. He sighed. Well, it's a bad business. The awful thing is that Addie and I can't help being glad, really, that she's dead.
He quelled a protest from his sister-in-law.
It's no good, Addie. I know what you feel. I feel the same, and I'm not going to pretend. But at the same time, if you know what I mean, I really am most awfully concerned for Jeff about the whole business. It's hit him very hard.
He stopped and stared towards the doors leading out of the lounge onto the terrace.
Well, well, see who's here. What an unscrupulous woman you are, Addie.
Mrs. Jefferson looked over her shoulder, uttered an exclamation and got up, a slight colour rising in her face. She walked quickly along the terrace and went up to a tall, middle-aged man with a thin brown face who was looking uncertainly about him.
Mrs. Bantry said, Isn't that Hugo MacLean?
Mark Gaskell said, Hugo MacLean it is, alias William Dobbin.
Mrs. Bantry murmured, He's very faithful, isn't he?
"'Dog-like devotion,' said Mark. "'Addie's only got to whistle, and Hugo comes trotting from any odd corner of the globe. "'Always hopes that some day she'll marry him. "'I dare say she will.'
"'Miss Marple looked beamingly after them. "'She said, "'I see, a romance.'
"'One of the good old-fashioned kind,' Mark assured her. "'It's been going on for years. "'Addie's that kind of woman.'
"'He added meditatively,
I suppose Addie telephoned him this morning. She didn't tell me she had.
Edwards came discreetly along the terrace and paused at Mark's elbow.
Excuse me, sir. Mr. Jefferson would like you to come up.
I'll come at once. Mark sprang up. He nodded to them, said, See you later, and went off.
Sir Henry leant forward to Miss Marple. He said,
Well, what do you think of the principal beneficiaries of the crime?
Miss Marple said thoughtfully, looking at Adelaide Jefferson as she stood talking to her old friend, I should think, you know, that she was a very devoted mother.
Oh, she is, said Mrs. Bantry. She's simply devoted to Peter.
She is the kind of woman, said Miss Marple, that everyone likes, the kind of woman that could go on getting married again and again. I don't mean a man's woman. That's quite different.
I know what you mean, said Sir Henry.
What you both mean, said Mrs. Bantry, is that she's a good listener.
Sir Henry laughed. He said, "And Mark Gaskell?"
"Ah," said Miss Marple, "he's a Downey fellow."
"Village parallel, please."
"Mr. Cargill, the builder. He bluffed a lot of people into having things done to their houses they never meant to do, and how he charged them for it. But he could always explain his bills away plausibly. A Downey fellow. He married money.
So did Mr. Gaskell, I understand." "You don't like him?"
"Yes, I do. Most women would. But he can't take me in. He's a very attractive person, I think, but a little unwise, perhaps, to talk as much as he does."
"Unwise is the word," said Sir Henry. "Mark will get himself into trouble if he doesn't look out."
A tall, dark young man in white flannels came up the steps to the terrace and paused, just for a minute, watching Adelaide Jefferson and Hugo MacLean.
"And that," said Sir Henry obligingly, "is X, whom we might describe as an interested party. He is the tennis and dancing pro, Raymond Starr, Ruby Keane's partner."
Miss Marple looked at him with interest. She said, "He's very nice-looking, isn't he?"
"I suppose so." "Oh, don't be absurd, Sir Henry," said Mrs. Bantry. "There's no supposing about it. He is good-looking."
Miss Marple murmured, "Mrs. Jefferson has been taking tennis lessons, I think she said."
"Do you mean anything by that, Jane, or don't you?"
Miss Marple had no chance of replying to this downright question. Young Peter Carmody came across the terrace and joined them. He addressed himself to Sir Henry.
"I say, are you a detective, too? I saw you talking to the superintendent. The fat one is a superintendent, isn't he?"
"Quite right, my son."
"And somebody told me you were a frightfully important detective from London, the head of Scotland Yard or something like that."
"The head of Scotland Yard is usually a complete dud in books, isn't he?"
"Oh, no, not nowadays. Making fun of the police is very old-fashioned. Do you know who did the murder yet?"
"Not yet, I'm afraid."
"Are you enjoying this very much, Peter?" asked Mrs. Bantry. "Well, I am, rather. Makes a change, doesn't it? I've been hunting round to see if I could find any clues, but haven't been lucky. I've got a souvenir, though. Would you like to see it?" "Fancy, Mother wanted me to throw it away. I do think one's parents are rather trying sometimes."
He produced from his pocket a small matchbox. Pushing it open, he disclosed the precious contents.
"See? It's a fingernail. Her fingernail. I'm going to label it Fingernail of the Murdered Woman and take it back to school. It's a good souvenir, don't you think?"
"Where did you get it?" asked Miss Marple.
"Well, it was a bit of luck, really, because, of course, I didn't know she was going to be murdered then. It was before dinner last night. Ruby caught her nail in Josie's shawl, and it tore it. Mum's cut it off for her, and gave it to me and said, 'Put it in the waste paper basket.' And I meant to, but I put it in my pocket instead. And this morning I remembered and looked to see if it was still there, and it was. So now I've got it as a souvenir."
"Oh, disgusting," said Mrs. Bantry. Peter said politely,
"Oh, do you think so?"
"Got any other souvenirs?" asked Sir Henry.
"Well, I don't know. I've got something that might be."
"Explain yourself, young man."
Peter looked at him thoughtfully. Then he pulled out an envelope. From the inside of it, he extracted a piece of brown, tapey substance.
"It's a bit of that chap George Bartlett's shoelace," he explained. "I saw his shoes outside the door this morning, and I bagged a bit, just in case."
"In case what?"
"In case he should be the murderer, of course. He was the last person to see her, and that's always frightfully suspicious, you know. Is it nearly dinner time, do you think? I'm frightfully hungry. It always seems such a long time between tea and dinner. Oh, hello, there's Uncle Hugo. I didn't know Mum's had asked him to come down. I suppose she sent for him. She always does if she's in a jam. Here's Josie coming. Hi, Josie."
Josephine Turner, coming along the terrace, stopped and looked rather startled to see Mrs. Bantry and Miss Marple.
Mrs. Bantry said pleasantly, "How do you do, Miss Turner? We've come to do a bit of sleuthing."
Josie cast a guilty glance around. She said, lowering her voice,
"It's awful. Nobody knows yet. I mean, it isn't in the papers yet. I suppose everybody will be asking me questions, and it's so awkward. I don't know what I ought to say."
Her glance went rather wistfully towards Miss Marple, who said, "Yes, it will be a very difficult situation for you, I'm afraid." Josie warmed to this sympathy.
"You see, Mr. Prescott said to me, 'Don't talk about it.' And that's all very well, but everyone is sure to ask me, and you can't offend people, can you? Mr. Prescott said he hoped I'd feel able to carry on as usual, and he wasn't very nice about it. So, of course, I want to do my best. And I really don't see why it should all be blamed on me."
Sir Henry said, "Do you mind me asking you a frank question, Miss Turner?"
"Oh, do ask me anything you like," said Josie, a little insincerely.
"Has there been any unpleasantness between you and Mrs. Jefferson and Mr. Gaskell over all this?"
"Over the murder, do you mean?"
"No, I don't mean the murder." Josie stood twisting her fingers together. She said rather sullenly, "Well, there has and there hasn't, if you know what I mean. Neither of them have said anything, but I think they blamed it on me. Mr. Jefferson taking such a fancy to Ruby, I mean. It wasn't my fault, though, was it? These things happen, and I never dreamt of such a thing happening beforehand, not for a moment. I was quite dumbfounded." Her words rang out with what seemed undeniable sincerity. Sir Henry said kindly, "I'm quite sure you were. But once it had happened..." Josie's chin went up.
"Well, it was a piece of luck, wasn't it? Everyone's got to have the right to have a piece of luck sometimes."
She looked from one to the other of them in a slightly defiant, questioning manner, and then went on across the terrace and into the hotel. Peter said judicially,
"I don't think she did it."
Miss Marple murmured, "It's interesting, that piece of fingernail. It had been worrying me, you know, how to account for her nails."
"Nails?" asked Sir Henry.
"The dead girl's nails," explained Mrs. Bantry. "They were quite short, and now that Jane says so, of course it was a little unlikely. A girl like that usually has absolute talons."
Miss Marple said, "But, of course, if she tore one off, then she might clip the others close, so as to match. Did they find nail pairings in her room, I wonder?" Sir Henry looked at her curiously. He said,
"I'll ask Superintendent Harper when he gets back."
"Back from where?"
asked Mrs. Bantry.
"He hasn't gone over to Gossington, has he?"
Sir Henry said gravely,
"No, there's been another tragedy. Blazing car in a quarry."
Miss Marple caught her breath. "Was there someone in the car?"
"I'm afraid so, yes."
Miss Marple said thoughtfully, "I expect that will be the girl guide who's missing. Pamela Reeves." Sir Henry stared at her.
"Now, why on earth do you think that, Miss Marple?"
Miss Marple got rather pink. "Well, it was given out on the wireless that she was missing from her home since last night, and her home was Danely Vale. That's not very far from here. And she was last seen at the Girl Guide rally up on Danebury Downs. That's very close indeed. In fact, she'd have to pass through Danemouth to get home. So it does rather fit in, doesn't it? I mean, it looks as though she might have seen, or perhaps heard, something that no one was supposed to see and hear. If so, of course, she'd be a source of danger to the murderer, and she'd have to be removed. Two things like that must be connected, don't you think?"
Sir Henry said, his voice dropping a little, "You think a second murder?"
"Why not?"
Her quiet, placid gaze met his. "When anyone has committed one murder, they don't shrink from another, do they? Nor even from a third."
"A third? You don't think there will be a third murder?"
"I think it's just possible. Yes, I think it's highly possible."
"Miss Marple," said Sir Henry, "you frighten me. Do you know who is going to be murdered?"
Miss Marple said, "I have a very good idea."
Superintendent Harper stood looking at the charred and twisted heap of metal. A burnt-out car was always a revolting object, even without the additional gruesome burden of a charred and blackened corpse. Venn's Quarry was a remote spot, far from any human habitation. Though actually only 2 miles as the crow flies from Danemouth, The approach to it was by one of those narrow, twisted, rutted roads, little more than a cart track, which led nowhere except to the quarry itself. It was a long time now since the quarry had been worked, and the only people who came along the lane were the casual visitors in search of blackberries. As a spot to dispose of a car, it was ideal. The car need not have been found for weeks, but for the accident of the glow in the sky having been seen by Albert Biggs, a labourer, on his way to work. Albert Biggs was still on the scene, though all he had to tell had been heard some time ago, but he continued to repeat the thrilling story with such embellishments as occurred to him.
"Why, dang my eyes," I said, "whatever be that, eh? Proper glow, 'twas up in the sky. Might be a bonfire," I says, "but we'll be having a bonfire over to Van's quarry." "No," I says, "'tis some mighty big fire, to be sure. But whatever would it be," I says, "there's no house nor farm to that direction. 'Tis over by Van's," I says. "That's where 'tis, to be sure." But I didn't rightly know what I ought to do about it. But seeing as Constable Gregg comes along just then on his bicycle, I tells him about it. Well, 'twas all died down by then, but I tells him just where 'twere. "'Tis over that direction," I says. "Big glare in the sky," I says. "Mayhap, as it's a rick," I says, "one of they tramps, as likely as not, set a light of it. But I did never think as how it might be a car, far less as someone was being burned up alive in it. 'Tis a terrible tragedy, to be sure."
The Glenshire police had been busy. Cameras had clicked, and the position of the charred body had been carefully noted before the police surgeon had started his own investigation. The latter came over now to Harper, dusting black ash off his hands, his lips set grimly together. "A pretty thorough job," he said. "Part of one foot and shoe are about all that has escaped. Personally, I myself couldn't say if the body was a man's or a woman's at the moment, though we'll get some indication from the bones, I expect. But the shoe is one of the black-strapped affairs, the kind schoolgirls wear." "There's a schoolgirl missing from the next county," said Harper. "Quite close to here. Girl of 16 or so." "Then it's probably her," said the doctor. "Poor kid," Harper said uneasily. "She wasn't alive when—" No, I don't think so. No sign of her having tried to get out. Body was just slumped down on the seat, with the foot sticking out. She was dead when she was put there, I should say. Then the car was set on fire in order to try and get rid of the evidence." He paused and asked, "Want me any longer?" "I don't think so, thank you. Right, I'll be off." He strode away to his car. Harper went over to where one of his sergeants, a man who specialised in car cases, was busy. The latter looked up. "Quite a clear case, sir. Petrol poured over the car, and the whole thing deliberately set light to. There are three empty cans in the hedge over there." A little farther away, another man was carefully arranging small objects picked out of the wreckage. There was a scorched black leather shoe, and with it some scraps of scorched and blackened material. As Harper approached, his subordinate looked up and exclaimed, "Look at this, sir. This seems to clinch it." Harper took the small object in his hand. He said, "Button from a girl guide's uniform?"
"Yes, sir."
"Yes," said Harper. "That does seem to settle it." A decent, kindly man, he felt slightly sick. First Ruby Keane, and now this child, Pamela Reeves. He said to himself, as he had said before, "What's come to Glenshire?" His next move was first to ring up his own chief constable, and afterwards to get in touch with Colonel Melchett. The disappearance of Pamela Reeves had taken place in Radfordshire, though her body had been found in Glenshire. The next task set him was not a pleasant one. He had to break the news to Pamela Reeves' father and mother. Superintendent Harper looked up consideringly at the facade of Bayside as he rang the front doorbell. Neat little villa, nice garden of about an acre and a half, the sort of place that had been built fairly freely all over the countryside in the last 20 years. Retired army men, retired civil servants, that type. Nice, decent folk. The worst you could say of them was that they might be a bit dull. Spent as much money as they could afford on their children's education.
not the kind of people you associated with tragedy. And now tragedy had come to them. He sighed. He was shown at once into a lounge where a stiff man with a grey moustache and a woman whose eyes were red with weeping both sprang up. Mrs. Reeves cried out eagerly, "You have some news of Pamela?" Then she shrank back, as though the superintendent's commiserating glance had been a blow. Harper said, "I'm afraid you must prepare yourself for bad news."
"Pamela?" faltered the woman.
Major Reeves said sharply, "Something's happened to the child?" "Yes, sir." "Do you mean she's dead?" Mrs. Reeves burst out, "Oh, no, no," and broke into a storm of weeping. Major Reeves put his arm round his wife and drew her to him. His lips trembled, but he looked inquiringly at Harper, who bent his head.
"An accident?"
"Not exactly, Major Reeves. She was found in a burnt-out car, which had been abandoned in a quarry."
"In a car? In a quarry?"
His astonishment was evident. Mrs. Reeves broke down altogether, and sank down on the sofa, sobbing violently. "Superintendent Harper said, if you'd like me to wait a few minutes?" Major Reeves said sharply, "What does this mean? Foul play?" "That's what it looks like, sir. That's why I'd like to ask you some questions, if it isn't too trying for you." "No. No, you're quite right. No time must be lost if what you suggest is true, but I can't believe it. Who would want to harm a child like Pamela?" Harper said stolidly, "You've already reported to your local police the circumstances of your daughter's disappearance. She left here to attend a guide's rally, and you expected her home for supper. That is right?"
"Yes."
"She was to return by bus?"
"Yes."
"I understand that, according to the story of her fellow guides, when the rally was over, Pamela said she was going into Danemouth to Woolworths and would catch a later bus home. That strikes you as quite a normal proceeding?"
"Oh, yes. Pamela was very fond of going to Woolworths. She often went into Danemouth to shop. The bus goes from the main road, only about a quarter of a mile from here."
"And she had no other plans, so far as you know?"
"None."
"She was not meeting anybody in Danemouth?"
"No, sure she wasn't. She would have mentioned it, if so. We expected her back for supper. That's why, when it got so late and she hadn't turned up, we rang up the police. It wasn't like her not to come home."
"Your daughter had no undesirable friends? That is, friends that you didn't approve of?"
"No, there was never any trouble of that kind."
Mrs. Reeves said tearfully, "Pam was just a child. She was very young for her age. She liked games and all that. She wasn't precocious in any way." "Do you know a Mr. George Bartlett who is at the Majestic Hotel in Danemouth?" Major Reeves stared.
"Never heard of him."
"You don't think your daughter knew him?"
"I'm quite sure she didn't."
He added sharply,
"How does he come into it?"
"He's the owner of the Minoan 14 car in which your daughter's body was found."
Mrs. Reeves cried, "But then he must," Harper said quickly.
"He reported his car missing early today. It was in the courtyard of the Majestic Hotel at lunchtime yesterday. Anybody might have taken the car."
"But didn't someone see who took it?"
The superintendent shook his head. "Dozens of cars going in and out all day, and a Minoan 14 is one of the commonest makes."
Mrs. Reeves cried, "But aren't you doing something? Aren't you trying to find the devil who did this? My little girl! My little girl! She wasn't burnt alive, was she? Oh, Pam! Pam!"
"She didn't suffer, Mrs. Reeves. I assure you she was already dead when the car was set alight."
Reeves asked stiffly, "How was she killed?"
Harper gave him a significant glance. "We don't know,
The fire had destroyed all evidence of that kind. He turned to the distraught woman on the sofa. "Believe me, Mrs. Reeves, we're doing everything we can. It's a matter of checking up. Sooner or later we shall find someone who saw your daughter in Danemouth yesterday and saw whom she was with. It all takes time, you know. We shall have dozens, hundreds of reports coming in about a girl guide who was seen here, there, and everywhere. It's a matter of selection and of patience. But we shall find out the truth in the end, never you fear." Mrs. Reeves asked,
Where is she? Can I go to her?"
Again, Superintendent Harper caught the husband's eye. He said, "The medical officer is attending to all that. I'd suggest that your husband comes with me now and attends to all the formalities. In the meantime, try and recollect anything Pamela might have said, something perhaps that you didn't pay attention to at the time, but which might throw some light upon things. You know what I mean, just some chance word or phrase. That's the best way you can help us." As the two men went towards the door, Reeves said, pointing to a photograph, "There she is." Harper looked at it attentively. It was a hockey group. Reeves pointed out Pamela in the centre of the team. "A nice kid," Harper thought, as he looked at the earnest face of the pigtailed girl. His mouth set in a grim line as he thought of the charred body in the car. He vowed to himself that the murder of Pamela Reeves should not remain one of Glenshire's unsolved mysteries. Ruby Keane, so he admitted privately, might have asked for what was coming to her, but Pamela Reeves was quite another story. A nice kid, if ever he saw one. He'd not rest until he hunted down the man or woman who'd killed her.
End of Disc 3. Please continue with the next disc.